High on a hill, a goodly cedar grew, of wondrous length and straight proportion, that fair abroad her dainted odorous threw, amongst all the daughters of proud Lebanon. Her match in beauty was not anyone. Edmund Spenser. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I hope you will enjoy the episode, and if you are a newcomer, welcome. I hope you'll avail yourself of our backlog of episodes. And for all of our returning listeners, I thank you for joining me. As always, I really appreciate all of your support. It means a lot. Now, this week, we are going to be moving north into the Central Levant and maybe Cyprus as well. We'll see. It's going to depend on how our time looks. But before that, though, I did want to go ahead and say next week episode, there might not be one, depending on what happens that weekend. I believe Monday is a holiday for everyone in the U.S., or at least most people in the U.S. I will be availing myself of that, and depending on travel, I might be delayed in returning, so I might not be able to record an episode next week. But if I do, we'll be back the following week at our normal time. So I just want people to be aware of that. So, with all the niceties and things like that out of the way, let's go ahead and move on to the meat of this week's episode. Now, like the region we discussed the last couple of weeks to the south, this region sees a wide range of weather and climatic shifts, which causes fluctuation in population density and lifestyles at a couple of different sites that are have existed or have been used periodically throughout, you know, human history and human occupation of the region. Though it's not quite as dramatic as the places to the south, and we'll go into the reasons why that is, and we'll also talk about the people occupying these places and some of the big sites associated with this region. Now, there are a number of different sites that are very, very old. There are, in fact, one of the strongest, if not the de facto candidate for the oldest occupied city is in what is now modern-day Lebanon, and this occupies most of what we're talking about. It's not a one-for-one for modern Lebanon with what I'm going to be talking about in this episode, but it's very close. There is some overlap with Syria and the northern bits of Israel and the West Bank, Palestine, so keep that in mind as well. But that city that I'm referring to is Byblos. Now, Byblos, well, that's the ancient name. That's what you'll see it mentioned in a lot of historical records, but today it is known as Jibil or Jibuyal, depending on the way you pronounce your Arabic. And I do, again, apologize for my Arabic pronunciation. I know it's not the strongest. And the modern city of Beirut is also, it has a claim to be the longest continually occupied or inhabited capital of any city in the world. Though, again, there is, you know, you can always quibble on that kind of thing, but I think both Byblos and Beirut both have a solid claim. There's very few, like, you know, strong contenders that that can kind of overthrow that. Now, there is a question on when these sites actually became cities and when, you know, when did they actually become like a true urban center? For example, Byblos or Jibel was occupied first around sometime between the mid 8th millennium to about 7000 BC, and then after that the site was abandoned, or if not fully abandoned, then just saw very limited seasonal occupation. But it becomes continuously inhabited right around 5000 BC, though at this period it is little more than a fishing village. As time goes on, it becomes a larger and more important city in the region. And this is true for a number of sites along the coast, starting as far south as even, again, in modern-day Israel, the site of, it's now known as Acre, but then you also have Tyre, Sidon, Beirut, as we mentioned, and Arvad and Byblos. These are kind of like the big coastal cities for a lot of prehistoric and then, of course, the historical period, Bronze Age, those type of times. All of these sites are being occupied, at least at some level, though again, it is a question of when they become true cities at this time. Since they're on the coast, you can imagine that they are all very reliant on fishing and things like that to help maintain their diet and population. But another factor in most of these sites is that they are on rivers. As I said, Lebanon is not a one-to-one comparison, or at least the modern country of Lebanon is not a one-to-one comparison, but it does take up a decent chunk of the region I'm talking about. And in the modern country, there are a number of rivers that are flowing from the Lebanon Mountains down to the Mediterranean Sea. All told, I think there's around 25 to 30 that do originate on the western face of those mountains, and then they run through gorges and things like that to get to the Mediterranean Sea. Most of these rivers are not navigable. I think 22 of those are cannot be traversed via boat of any kind, even small like rafts and things like that. And that is going to be kind of one of the challenges that these cities are going to face with getting into the interior or trading through to the interior. You do kind of have to have a mix of overland and sea routes to trade, though they do overcome these barriers. When we get to the historical period, we'll see that very strongly. Now, these rivers, of course, carry fresh water, so that does allow for some level of permanent agricultural to happen. But you do also have a large amount of other vegetation that takes advantage of this. Lebanon, or at least the modern country of Lebanon, has a cedar flag, or a cedar tree on its flag, and historically, the region is a very important source of timber and lumber for a lot of different civilizations. Egypt makes special note of sending expeditions to obtain fine woods and things like that for their temples, ships, all that kind of thing. Very early in Egyptian history, there is records of them trading with the coastal settlements along this stretch of the Mediterranean. And of course, places in Mesopotamia as well are trading for the timber and lumbers. And as you might imagine, this leads to a number of conflicts, both between these various cities and both their neighbors, their large neighbors to the north and to the, to the south and to the east. Not to mention with each other and, them being caught in the middle of conflicts between those neighbors. That's going to be one of the defining hallmarks of the history of this region for quite a while. But these rivers are also part of the reason that the population centers in these areas are able to urbanize slightly faster than what you'll see to the places to the south that we've talked about the last couple of weeks. Now, you also have an area known as the Beka Valley or Beka Valley or Beka. It's transliterated in a few different ways into English. But this is a very large, very fertile valley that is between the Lebanon mountain range and the anti-Lebanon mountains to the east. It's around 120 kilometers long, 16 kilometers wide, which is like 75 miles in length to about 10 miles in width. And this is a very important agricultural zone for the entire region. It's also one of the first places you see evidence of wine grown locally in the Levant. And this is probably from this region that you got some of the places we talked about last week getting their wine from, and getting their eventually getting their grapes and things like that to make wine from, or rather to produce their own wine. Although they'll still, of course, import wine from the area because, yeah, you can't always make enough locally, and that's true of a lot of different things. Even if you have access to, you know, decent sources. Now, the Beka Valley has three rivers that are in this region. The Litani River, which is also known as the Kasamia, and the ancient name for it was the Leontis, or the Lion River. This is the one that kind of, it forms in the kind of southern part of the Beka Valley, and it flows south, picks up another couple of rivers, and then it empties out into the Mediterranean. Now, the Orontes River, or the Asi River, is the one that kind of, it forms in the north to the west side of the anti-Lebanon mountains. So this one actually flows kind of to the it flows to the west and then curves up to the north. And this will be important later, because there's another city that forms around it that I'll talk about here shortly. And then you also have the Hasbani or the Nahal Snir River, and this is kind of forms in the southern part of the valley, and it's one of the major tributaries for the Jordan River, so it flows completely to the south. Though itself is not, it's not nearly as large of a river as either the Litani or the Asi rivers. Now, moving past the anti-Lebanons, further inland to the east, you come across another city, or at least a site that will become a city. And in fact, it is one of the few cities that can really challenge Beirut as the longest inhabited capital city for a modern state, and it can conceivably challenge Byblos for one of the, if not the longest inhabited city, and that is the city of Damascus. Now, I should say that there is a lot of debate about Damascus's claim on this, at least in the archaeological sphere. Now, Damascus does show evidence of habitation before Byblos by about 200 to 500 years, give or take, though the amount of habitation is very small, and there is a question of whether or not this was a true settlement, like if it's a site for sedentary living or if it was just a kind of a regional seasonal camps, a large-scale camping site. And I will say that showing up in the historical record, it does not show up until well after either Byblos or Beirut appears in the historical record of people talking about it. I think it loses out to them by about somewhere between 1,000 to 1,200 years. Though, again, that doesn't mean that it wasn't a city before then. That's just the earliest records we have of it being talked about. Now, Damascus is a fairly arid area, so it can't really have a huge population, at least at earlier periods. But that's not to say it couldn't have a permanent population, even after the 9000 BC date. Very probable that there are a number of small pastoral groups making use of the area. Even if they can't support a large agricultural base, they could at least kind of give a decent amount of water. There is a river that rolls through. It's named the Barada River. And it basically gets its yearly flow from snows melting and coming down from the Anti-Lebanons. But this site will become one of those very important overland routes I talked about. So Damascus is also in the running for, you know, one of the long inhabited cities, or permanent, or, you know, most contiguously inhabited cities. It kind of depends on what your definition of the city is, which is one of those things that's always, you know, heavily debated. But yeah, so just keep that in mind. The introduction of pack animals is really probably what helps Damascus grow quicker once things like donkeys and camels enter this region. That allows them to trade not with just people to the south, in the region we were talking about in the last couple of weeks, but also it makes it easier for a large-scale trade with kind of the center Mesopotamian region. And of course, they can get through the mountains to the Bekaa Valley, and then from there, those contacts can reach the coastal settlements. So Damascus may have been a very old site that, you know, in its early day was more dependent on its larger, closer neighbors, whereas as time goes on, it will become more independent and more, once it has a reliable means of securing its own transportation long range. So that is something that we'll keep an eye on when we talk about this region going forward. Now, in terms of who these people are, who's living here, much like the places we talked about last time, this is a region associated with the expansion of Semitic speakers, or the Proto-Semitic speakers, as the case may be. But they probably also were interacting with, again, older Afro-Asiatic speaking peoples who had occupied the region, but they also have links to southern Anatolia, northern Mesopotamia, and things like that. So there is and of course, with all the trade going through, there's a lot of different travel back and forth between regions by various groups. It's important to remember, like we talked about last time, that there's not one single ethnic group that's occupying the area. And even into the historical period, there are a number of different ethnic groups interacting with, mixing each other, and eventually forming their own separate regional identities. For instance, the coastal cities along the corridor that I mentioned, Byblos, Sidon, Tyre, those areas, they are, technically speaking, part of the Canaanite branch of Semitic speakers. So you have to think that, you know, there's a Canaanite base at some point. And by base, I mean like a chunk of their population that is related to the Canaanite peoples. But, at least with the people further north in the central Levant, they probably have less interactions with the Egyptians of the Delta. And they probably have more direct contacts with Anatolians to the north. And there is another factor that we should discuss, and that is the migrations and peoples living in the kind of the Fertile Crescent towards northern Mesopotamia. In fact, there is a city that is kind of going to be involved with all of this that is not Damascus and not along the coast, but along the Orontes River towards the north of the Bekaa Valley. And that city is known as Karkar. Now, this is a site that was occupied during the pre-pottery period, around 8,500. And it seems like it goes through regular periods of occupation. It ebbs and flows, much like the sites that we're talking about this week to the south in central Levant. It maintains some level of habitation during these entire periods. However, materially, culturally, it appears more in line with sites in the Mesopotamian sphere. So, but Karkar also has a lot of trade links with their closer neighbors. So there is a mix there of Mesopotamian and these proto-Canaanite cities in the central and southern Levant. So that's something that we'll be kind of keeping an eye on as time goes on. So there's a very heavy mix, especially in this region, of multiple peoples coming in, setting up their own societies, but also not necessarily rejecting their neighbors outright. There's kind of a mix and blend. And you'll see this when we get to the historical period, or a more historical period, I guess, talking about like religion and things like that. So there's a lot of back and forth, again, in this region. In fact, there's more back and forth in this region as opposed to the southern Levant. Those guys are a little bit more isolated. And again, partly that's due to just environmental and climatic factors. All that said, though, it does appear as if the coastal settlements are a little bit more technologically advanced, especially Byblos. That's where you see a lot of the big hallmarks of antiquity kind of hit first. They're the first to kind of adopt large-scale creation of pottery. They are the first to really adapt copper and then later bronze. And that's happening right at the end of this season, about 4,500 to about 4,000. And you see that, you know, they adopt kind of the whole pot burials that we talked about last time, and also grave goods, things like that. So Byblos appears to kind of be the center point of quote-unquote civilization in the region. Though, again, this is not in a vacuum. This is happening in conjunction with the places we've talked about further south and the places we'll be talking about a little bit further north and to the east in the next few episodes. But that being said, we are going to take a detour to the island of Cyprus. And I think that's going to be its own episode. This isn't that long of an episode, but I just kind of wanted to give people an idea of the sites and the peoples that are, you know, meeting now, or, you know, more clearly meeting now. They've obviously had contacts well before then, or before this season. I think this is kind of a good place to stop, a nice little short episode before we move on to Cyprus, and that'll probably be one whole episode, and then we'll talk about the very north of the Levant, and then we'll move east into Mesopotamia, and then we'll probably cover Anatolia and the Caucasus in a couple of episodes, and then we'll continue on further east into Asia. So I might kind of work that around. I might cover Cyprus, then Anatolia, northern Levant region, and then move east. I'm not 100% sure yet on how to do that. I'd like to thank everyone for listening and for joining me this week. If you have any questions, feedback, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can also contact me via direct message on Twitter. You can comment on the YouTube video that I'll post a link to, on the episode of the description that I always do. And, I do stream live on YouTube most days during the week and sometimes on the weekends. So please feel free to reach out there. Just know that if you do want to chat on YouTube, you can't post links. YouTube doesn't allow that. So if you just want to send me something article-wise, please do so there. I'm not going to do a religion episode for the early Canaanites and Levantine cities. Not a whole lot to go on for this period. There's still, evidence of skull cults, ancestor worship, but by the time we get to the historical period, we're in the realm of gods and goddesses at that point. Baal, specifically. Baal's a very big, if you're familiar with the Hebrew Bible, Baal is one of the big Canaanite deities, and also a very big deity in the area we've just been discussing. In fact, according to some sources, Baal even founded the city of Byblos. He's credited with founding the city of Byblos. He may have even been the first deity worshipped there. It's hard to say for sure. I haven't dived too much on the subject, but that is something we will talk about when we get back to this region for our next season. So I hope you look forward to that. But yeah, thank you all for joining me. And again, any questions, comments, feedback, feel free to reach out however you'd like. Don't be shy or afraid or anything like that. I do like hearing from listeners. So thank you all, and I hope you have a good rest of your week and or day whenever you're hearing this. And thank you all. I'll see y'all next time. Peace.